So back in the fall of 1997, Sports Illustrated assigned me to write up a preview of the Edmonton Oilers' upcoming NHL season. In 26-year-old Doug Waite, I wrote, Edmonton has a star in waiting. Waite scored 82 points last year and looks ready to have the kind of 40-goal, 70-assist season the number 99 used to make look easy. Doug never takes a night off, says general manager Glenn Slather. Throw in forwards Jason Arnott, Ryan Smith, Mike Greer, Andrei Kovalenko, Todd Marchmont, and Dean McArmett, none of whom is older than 27, and coach Ron Lowe has what might be the NHL's top collection of young guns. We're definitely legit, says Waite. We've got to be one of the top 10 teams. All these years later, after insisting to the magazine's editors that I was the right guy to tackle the National Hockey League, I have a confession to make. I'd never watched a single hockey game at any level, ever. I just wanted the byline. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 9 books and the host of Two Writers, Sing and Yang, a podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. Today's episode stars Seth Abramovich, senior writer for The Hollywood Reporter, whose recent piece on Shelley Duvall, the reclusive actress who struggled with mental illness, was exploited by the king of douchebags, Dr. Phil, came out a few days ago and was pure freaking genius. This is episode number 195. Let's sling some yang. So Seth, I'm sitting in front of my computer the other day and I see Shelley Duvall trending on Twitter. My first thought, which is always a first thought on Twitter with an elder celebrity, is shit, Shelley Duvall died.
Right.
But she didn't die. You just happened to write this amazing profile for the Hollywood Reporter about Shelley Duvall. And the title of the story was Searching for Shelley Duvall, the reclusive icon on fleeing Hollywood and the scars of making The Shining. And I think most people listening to this are probably familiar with the fact that she got completely blindsided, railroaded, screwed, whatever you want to say, by Dr. Phil a few years ago, who took complete advantage of a woman who obviously was struggling. I'm interested first, how did you even find her and get her to agree to talk to you?
I mean, the short version is that I do a kind of historical page at the back of every Hollywood Reporter. And so it was the 40th anniversary of Popeye recently. And for me, that was the sweet spot. Like, I was 7 or 8 when that came out, and that was when I discovered her. For a lot of other people, it was the fairy tale theater that she did on Showtime and stuff like that. But for me, it was Popeye. And then later in life, I discovered The Shining and that amazing performance, and then her Robert Altman films. But it definitely put her in mind. And the first thing that came to mind was the Dr. Phil thing, and which I had almost blocked out. I mean, I just remember it being bad, but I didn't remember how bad. But unfortunately for doing this piece, I had to go re-experience it, and it was worse than I remembered. Not just in the state that she was in, but also the way it was edited and the terminology. And he called her an ex-star, and it was, and lots of like those kind of 90s like tabloid video journalism cuts of like weird angles, and it was really awful. And it just occurred to me that I was like, well, that's not fair. Like, why is that the thing that pops in your head when you think of Shelley Duvall? That's why should that be the final word on it? And so then I started to think, well, is she still around, and can I do something with her now and celebrate all the great things she's done? And I just started snooping around online, and there was a site called So Shelley Duvall. They have an Instagram and a Twitter, and they struck that, you know, adoring tone that I had in mind, you know, with all the beautiful shots of her when she was young and thin and cute. And so I contacted them and I said, well, do you have any way into her? And they said, I don't, but they gave me some leads. And I followed those leads, and the leads are what led me to my first conversation with her on the phone. And I introduced myself, and she was a little bit surprised to hear from me, but she used to be a subscriber to The Hollywood Reporter. So she was definitely like happy to hear from The Hollywood Reporter. I think it meant something to her and reminded her of her career. And I think she's in a place right now where she wants to be remembered a bit. I think she misses a lot of her friends from Hollywood, and I think she, you know, in a way she feels that she does want to be remembered as that person. So so that just started a series of conversations where I got to know her a bit and she got to know me, and I proposed the idea of doing this story, and she's very humble, and I think she thought it would be something small, and I was like, no, I want to do something bigger, and you know, bring a photographer, and how do you feel about that? And eventually she just said, sure, come on down. And I said, she told me kind of how to get there. And so I flew out on a, you know, on a wing and a prayer, and not, you know, figuring the worst that could happen is it doesn't work out. And the best that could happen is what exactly happened. So I'm glad I took the risk.
Are you worried when you go that you're going to find the person that Dr. Phil put before us? You know, is that a concern at all, that you're going to go down and you're going to find this mental wreck of a person?
Well, you know, the phone calls were what convinced me that that she was interview ready. Like, you know, she, when anything had to do with, you know, Popeye or any movie or person, her memories were like strikingly vivid and precise. And that's what I wanted to talk about. I didn't want to talk about mental illness, really. I mean, it's a factor, but that's not what this story was about. I wanted to remember all the great things she had done. So, and then of course, The Shining has become, you know, so much bigger even than, you know, when it first came out and I had first seen it. It's become a religion for people. And so I knew if she had stories to tell about The Shining, then right there, that could be a story.
That's really interesting. But
there was, you know, there were definitely moments in these conversations where she'd say something out of nowhere that certainly didn't, you know, make sense, that I would get a little bit nervous, like, uh-oh. But then she would sort of, I would just sort of like engage that and not say, oh, that's crazy. Or, you know, just be like, ask her a few questions about that and then guide her back to the things I wanted to talk about. And then she would go right back to those. So my, I was feeling, you know, definitely optimistic that if I went, I would have enough for a story. But she gave me way more than enough. I mean, we spent a whole day together and just talking was over 3 hours. And of that, you know, I'd say 2/3 of it was highly usable, and I used a lot of it in the story. So yeah, she has issues, but who doesn't? And that was kind of my feeling. As like, people are like, oh, well, I saw her in Dr. Phil, and are you sure you want to do that? And I was like, well, everyone has their problems, you know, and I've had struggles with mental issues, and I don't know many people who haven't. And it doesn't mean wiping away everything else she'd achieved. That was sort of the point, was why does it have to wait for her obituary to say, oh, she did this and this and this. You know, I wanted to change her Google results, basically.
So the lead to your story, you wrote, out on the tranquil banks of a river in Texas Hill Country, Shelley Duvall pulls up in a white Toyota 4Runner. Her favorite place to sit is the driver's seat. It's also the only place to sit. The rest of the car is filled from floor to roof with a crush of acquisitions, including a bucket of plastic silverware, a jar of Green Giant sliced mushrooms, and a bouquet of silk roses. Duvall, 71, passes entire days in her car, chatting with locals and snacking on takeout food. She shares a home in the area with Dan Gilroy, 76, a member of the early Madonna band Breakfast Club. Gilroy was briefly romantically linked to the singer, but has been with Duvall since 1989, the two having fallen in love while co-starring in the Disney Channel movie Mother Goose Rock and Rhyme. Produced by Duvall, it features an all-star cast and has become an abiding cultural touchstone among millennials. There's little chance any of the passersby would recognize Duvall as Little Bo Peep for that movie, or for that matter, as Wendy Torrance from The Shining, the part for which she is best known. Her hair is thin and grayed, her breathy Minnie Mouse voice gone gravelly, and then you put she chain smokes parliaments, and her trademark stick figure, the one that she used to full advantage playing Olive Oil in Robert Altman's Popeye, has filled out. But there are tells, her eyes still sparkle even from a distance, and her toothy grin is warm and familiar. And it's a really, to me, fascinating sliver of writing there, because you put it all out there. Like, she's in this car, she's got shit in her car, you know, she doesn't look like she used to. That could easily have read depressing, but it didn't read depressing. It's sort of a magical little thing you did there. Like, I feel like Dr. Phil would have taken that and been like, look at this woman, what a mess. And you took it and said, she's not quite where you remember, but here's Shelley Duvall, and she's done all these great things. That seems really difficult to pull off, actually. Am I overstating this one?
I don't know. I mean, maybe. Maybe from the outside, it seems like a high wire act. For me, I didn't overthink this one. To be honest, of all the stories I've read, this is in the lower half in terms of difficulty. I read it. I wrote it. I mean, all the stories I've written. I wrote it in two sittings, really, over 2 days. It didn't change much from the first draft. And I think it's because I was just doing what I felt compelled to do, which was take her at face value and not pity her, or, you know, like, just celebrate her. And like I said before, everyone has their issues, and everyone, you know, like, and, you know, I work for the Hollywood Reporter, but the glam and all that stuff is the aspect of the job that is least interesting to me. Like, I do find real people way more interesting. And I find stories about, you know, redemption and comebacks and difficulties, like, those are the stories I gravitate to. So I guess part of me was like, do I want to reveal that, you know, her car is a bit hoardy so quickly? But at the same time, she had cool stuff in there, you know? There was a lot to see, and she likes it. And if it makes her happy, then, like, that's good. That's a good thing. And if she likes to smoke, then that's a good thing too. I mean, at this point, she's earned a right to have any kind of retirement she wants. So I don't know. Yeah, I guess it was risky, but, you know, I let my editors read it and make sure that they felt it was okay. But, you know, I was ready for any kind of backlash on it. But very happily, you know, people read it in the way that I intended, which is that there's nothing wrong with any of this.
I'm going to ask you a super weird question. I don't think I've never asked anyone on this podcast. It's like episode number 195. I've never asked anyone this question. Mm-hmm. You're sitting with Shelley Duvall. You're spending the day with Shelley Duvall. Mm-hmm. She's chain smoking parliaments. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing you don't smoke. Maybe you do smoke. Are you allowed to be like, do you mind if I open the window, or can I, you know?
Oh, well, you know, it was all done outside, first of all, for COVID reasons, but also because, like I say, her car is her favorite place. That's where she's most comfortable. It's like Linus's blanket, as long as she's sitting in there with all her stuff. So I was perfectly happy to interview her with her in her car, the window open, and me at a safe distance.
Right.
So no, the smoking didn't bother me because it was in her car and I was outside. So no, didn't bother.
You're very good. I've read a ton of your stories. Like, you're very, very good at getting celebrities to sort of open up and feel comfortable with you. That is very obvious. And my background is mainly in sports writing. And I always feel like it's the challenge to get people to open up to you when they've been told much of their careers, don't open up, don't open up, don't open up. You know, there are things you got to keep to yourself. How do you do it? Like, what are the ways you make people feel comfortable talking to you?
You know, I don't have a technique. I come to them without judgment, I guess, is like the one thing. Like, I want to hear your story, no matter who you are, or how down and out, or at the top of anything. Like, everyone is dealing with their own shit. And so I come to them maybe as a friend, or, you know, no agenda, just, I just want to know. And we just strike up a conversation, and it's not one-sided. I share too, but my things that I've been through, and hopefully, you know, I get them feeling comfortable with me or entrusting of me, that I'm not going to abuse the things they're sharing. And I just try to make a friendship with them, with the understanding that it's not a traditional friendship and that I'm there to interview them. But, you know, you got to make them feel good. And then once they feel good, they feel open to share things with you. Also, if you laugh a lot, and I don't fake laugh, but, you know, if they're saying something funny and you're laughing, that makes them feel good. And they'll usually talk more. I wish I could say that there's some trick to it. It's like you said before, it's like, okay, you come in this car, that's great. You know, to me, it's like, that's interesting. That's not bad. You know, so just don't bring with no judgments, and usually they'll open up to you.
What do you do if you're interviewing Shelley Duvall and all of a sudden she starts going off on whatever, a QAnon conspiracy theory, or the 12 Jews are owning the planet, or blah, 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 blah. When you're there to do sort of a appreciative piece on Shelley Duvall.
Well, she had moments where she went off on weird tangents, not the things you listed. I mean, she's not plugged into any kind of political anything, but definitely out there things. You know, one thing that struck me is how brilliant she was and that the things she was saying were so, you know, very complex and references, even though they didn't actually make sense in the context she was saying them, that she clearly has a high intellect. But you know, you just kind of had to ride it out. And, the first thing I would always say is if she seemed in distress at all, I would just say, are you okay? Do you need anything? Should we take a break? Can I get you something to eat? And just make sure that she felt okay. And then she would usually sort of calm down and then we would start again. But you know, my forte is not dealing with mental illness. My forte is you know, being an interviewer. So it was different from anything I had done before. I mean, the closest thing to it was I did a profile of Gary Busey, who had a severe head injury from a motorcycle accident and has never been quite the same since. And to me, that was the sort of the proof of concept for this piece, because I was very hesitant to go into that one. And I spent a day at his house in Malibu, and he was doing some really crazy shit, and things got a little crazy. He had this parakeet that kept like yelling, and he would yell, and it was a bit crazy, but we did have a decent interview. And then what unlocked that one was his son, Jake Busey, who's also an actor. He explained really just how severe this accident was and how different his personality was after the accident. And that unlocked the whole story for me. And so Gary Busey stopped being this kind of joke character from Entourage and was, you know, a bit of a tragic story, but again, living on his own terms and happy and doing things and still around. So I thought, well, no matter how weird things get, I did that one. And if I can apply that to this one, this could really work. But you know, in the end, she was a delight. Like I would say 80% of our time together was just beautiful recollections of her life and career, very vivid, specific ones. There were so many I didn't use. She had dated Ringo Starr, and I asked her about that. And she recounted the entire first date to me, where they went to see a concert with his kids and then dropped his kids at home. Like she remembers all this stuff perfectly. So for an interviewer, that's all you want. Certainly like this kind of profile of looking back on someone's career.
Now, why wouldn't you use a Ringo Starr, like a story about her first date with a member of the Beatles? What made you decide not to use that?
Well, because I only had a certain number of pages in. I could have gone into a million different directions, but I was trying to tell, you know, the essential version of her biography. And so I could have stuck that in, but I mean, the other thing was that I couldn't get a lot of these people to talk. And so Ringo Starr, you know, declined a request for an interview. Paul Simon declined a request for an interview. So, you know, it's fun when you have their side of it too. But in the end, it was all these amazing movie icons, females from, you know, Lily Tomlin, Sissy Spacek, Angelica Houston, who said yes right off the bat the second they heard that I was doing this. And I think that says a lot too about whatever this sisterhood of actresses of a certain generation and looking out for each other. I mean, I thought that was really beautiful. So I ended up focusing on those things less than other things. But yeah.
Hey, when you reach out to like, I was interested in that because you did have a lot of sort of big time Hollywood peers quoted in the story. Do you just call their rep and hope that they're interested? Is it as simple as that?
Yeah. You go through their publicist and, you know, I just said, I'm doing a tribute to Shelley Duvall. I found her. She's okay. It's a very loving tribute. And she mentioned, you know, you in the case of all three of them, she mentioned all three and how much she, you know, fond memories and how much she liked them. And so I said, you know, she mentioned you and I'd love to get you in the story. And all three of them said yes, right off the bat. There was one other actress who asked for her number and wanted to get her okay. And she doesn't answer the phone religiously. It's kind of like hit or miss. So she didn't. And so that actress asked not, you know, said she didn't want to do it without her blessing, which I totally understand. But I thought it was quite something that the other three, considering their stature in Hollywood, said yes.
Do you, you've written obviously about a ton of actors, actresses, famous people, blah, blah, blah. And I've always been fascinated by the damage that fame can do to people and ego and being told you're amazing 1,000 times and being told how great you are and the spotlight and blah, blah, blah. And you've written a lot about a lot of celebrities sort of on the fade part of their career, you know, when they're older and they're not as famous anymore. Am I overstating that, or is there something to be said for the decline from fame that interests you in a way, because there's something interesting about it?
Totally. Yeah. Like I said before, I mean, I've done, you know, major, like I did a Lakeith Stanfield cover and he's amazing, but he's a weird, dark guy. So like that definitely, you know, was fun for me to do, but you know, people that where everything's going their way right now, I don't know. It's hard to sort of, to turn that into a compelling narrative. Someone who's best days are behind them, or who've had some kind of major fall from grace and are building their way back. I mean, those are the stories that are more interesting to me, or who are reconfiguring their careers. Like, Jim Belushi's story I did where he's like a pop farmer now. It's like, that was really interesting to me. And then making the dots to the death of his brother and what, you know, what would have, cause he could just be hanging out in Hollywood with his money, but he's really passionate about it. So yeah, it's always the more, I guess, the offbeat. I don't know. They just call it like a Seth story at work, but there's a certain kind of story that, you know, everything isn't going great, but people are being very human that I'm very attracted to.
You mentioned the Gary Busey story, and it ran August 22nd, 2019. Says Gary Busey, set to play God, believes, quote, there is no death. And that's the headline and subhead. And you have a paragraph here. How Busey's injury, because you mentioned he had a serious injury after a motorcycle accident. How Busey's injury manifests itself can be amusing or insulting or downright disturbing. During the shoot, he asks a slender male photo assistant, did you used to be a woman? You came out great. Later, he turns to a female hairstylist and says, if you're not having fun, I have something fun for you. I have something for you to have fun. I'll tickle you till you pee. At one point, when I interject that I find something he says interesting, he snaps, you've interrupted me, so I won't continue. He later apologizes. Whenever he's pleased with something he said, which is often, he punctuates it with a high-pitched, yeah. His pet parakeet, Greeny, mimics a sound from its cage, adding to the air of chaos. When Busey is around, anything can happen and probably will. Best to just give yourself over to it. So you're writing about this guy who's had a serious sort of mental trauma that has manifested itself over 30 years. And his son admits to you that he's got, you know, he's never been the same guy. Is there a way to write about that with humor, but, and to make clear the gravity of it, but also not to fully insult him? It seems like that's a little bit of a trick as well.
Yeah. That was another one where I was like, do I say what's actually happening here or not? But, you know, he's also very funny. Like, a lot of those things made me laugh, even though they're totally inappropriate. And we were laughing on the set. But, you know, I see, for me, for with him, it was, he had developed this persona, and Entourage had kind of gelled it into what I think most people thought of when they thought of him. And it's like this sort of like shaman kind of hippie guy who like says weird stuff, and he had become a sort of joke version of himself. And so when I unraveled it and realized, oh, well, it was because of this injury, then I was like, okay, I can present him as that, but I can also, you know, explain what led to that and that there was pain behind that and, you know, what the son had to go through and how it affected his son's career and, you know, like, but to me, it's like life is life and, you know, everything isn't always perfect. And that's interesting. That's real. So I don't know. Do you feel like I went too far in revealing?
No, I don't actually. I thought it was a really interesting balancing act where it's like, wow, this is, I find him fascinating. I'm kind of sympathetic toward him. I don't like him, but I don't hate him.
I mean, I like him. He can't help it. And I don't know. I was just trying to like give the reader a sense of the chaos in the room at the time and like just how nutty things were, like, you know, like an old, I don't know, movie or whatever, like a Peter Sellers movie. It just was like everything was going wrong. And I was just trying to get to the root of who this guy is. So I could have not included that, but to me that was part of the story, you know. If you want me to write about you, then I'm going to write about everything I observe, not just
you. Always tape recording?
Yeah, we're taking notes.
And then do you transcribe everything yourself if you're recording it?
The recording I'll send to someone to transcribe for me.
Oh, that's a nice perk. Yeah, that's good. It's my least favorite part of the job by far, is transcribing.
Yeah, that's one of the perks of my job, is that they will get it transcribed.
Right. So but our
I developed a relationship with my transcriptionist who I trust implicitly. So she, with the Shelley thing, I was like, look, you know, this has to be, I mean, everything that exchange is completely, you know, non-disclosure agreement. But I said that some of this is a sensitive, and she, you know, she's had mental health. So you just gave her a little heads up.
Before we continue with two writers slinging yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman. I'm here with my daughter, Casey, who will be leaving for college next fall with dreams of becoming a high school history teacher.
Fashion designer.
I thought your dream was to educate.
It is, but ever since you introduced me to 503 Sports, kings of the throwback sports merchandise, my eyes have been opened to the wonders of fashion.
I don't get it.
Dad, my new dream is to come up with all sorts of amazing designs for 503 Sports. So when the USFL games start up later this year, I'll have created all this merchandise for fans to wear to the stadiums of their favorite teams. Go Wranglers! Go Stars! Go Stallions!
Casey, the USFL died more than 30 years ago. It's not a thing anymore.
Well, that makes my future look pretty bleak, doesn't it?
In sports, it's become an increasing thing. So it used to be when you were writing about an athlete, especially an active athlete, you would you'd show up at whatever the Lakers are playing. You'd show up at the locker room. You get there the hour and a half beforehand. You go up to a player. You say, hey, can I grab you for 20 minutes? Blah, blah, blah. Okay, sure. We sit down. Those days are pretty much over. Now, if you want a star, you have to go through a publicist or a handler or his sneaker rep or his agent. It's a freaking nightmare. How big of an obstacle in your career are publicists and handlers? And is there a way to sort of work that in a way that's, you know, is effective?
You know, I've had really great experiences with publicists, and obviously not all of them. And if the first person you'll get an angry phone call from is a publicist, but you know, if we're using this as an example, I contacted Angelica Houston's publicist. She passed along the request to Angelica. Angelica wanted to do it, and they set it up. And they weren't, as far as I know, they weren't on the call. And she was wonderful, and it worked out great. So I've had interviews where the publicist wants to sit in, and I don't love it, but, you know, you use... I mean, you could always walk away and say, well, you know, I can't do this with the publicist here, but usually I get something good out of the interview anyway.
Have you ever said no? Have you ever said, as a publicist ever said, can I sit in on this? And you're just like, I prefer you don't.
I mean, no, because I don't want to cause a scene. And if they're doing it, it's because the client wants it. And I don't know. It's like if they started interrupting a lot during the conversation, then I might have a problem with it. But if they're just listening in and they want to have their record of what happened, then I don't particularly object to it.
Right. I always worry. My worry is that it will impact if the person knows that someone else is listening and they're representative of blank, a team or a sneaker company or whatever, it might change the dynamic of the interview. But it's a pretty helpless feeling sometimes.
Yeah, no, I get that. I guess if the publicist is sitting in, it's because it's maybe a higher profile person or, yeah, I don't know. I just do my thing, and usually it's because I need this person for some reason, so I'm just happy to have them, you know.
Right. I think my favorite story of yours that I read was, it ran last January, so almost a year ago. It was a little more than a year ago. It was Pee Wee Herman's Dark Reboot. Paul Reubens is ready to stage a comeback.
Right.
I love this story, number one, because obviously I used to love Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and, you know, I thought, mm-hmm. and he's a fascinating character. And your lead real quick is Paul Rubens has chosen the meeting place, a retro diner not far from the Hollywood home he's lived in for 35 years, paid for with his earnings from 1985's Pee-wee's Big Adventure. But he does not arrive, as one might hope, on a red beach cruiser outfitted with a Tiger Super siren horn. He pulls up in a silver Honda Accord, and he's not wearing a two sizes too tight gray suit and red bow tie. He's in rimless glasses, a brown corduroy jacket, and a navy button down. He might easily be mistaken for a tax attorney. You know, my picture used to be up on the wall here, he says, after settling down in a booth and ordering a hamburger. And then they sold it, and all of a sudden it wasn't a show business pictures anymore. But it used to be me. And you know, picture or not, Rubens, now 67, is having a late career moment, or at least he's trying his hardest to make one happen. It's a freaking great story. It's a really joyful, fascinating look at a guy. See, I think this is definitive. Like the stuff I feel like that I've read of yours that you do really well. It's the guy who is a superstar trying to make a comeback, walking the tightrope of that existence where you're trying to make a comeback, but it could easily fall apart or it could possibly happen. Mm-hmm. Was he a good interviewer or bad? I can't even tell. Was Rubens a good guy to talk to, or were you like, oh, this guy's really annoying?
No, not annoying at all. He was lovely. He's just, and you'll hear this from people who have met him, you know, he's a bit of a mystery, hard to unravel, and he's very controlling. And he openly admits that himself. He's a control freak. And so, you know, very considered in what he shares, but very generous in what he shares as well. But there were certain areas that I would sort of veer towards, and he would slam shut like a clam. But that's cool if you have your boundaries, and you know, I totally respect that too. You know, you don't have to answer anything I ask you. But you know, that made him interesting. The fact that that diner was the 101 Cafe on Franklin in LA, which recently closed. And it was funny to me that he wanted to meet there because it's such a busy public place, but I don't know if he wanted to be seen or what, but you know, it wouldn't have been my first choice. It was so loud.
Right.
And we had two lunches there, but he was great. I mean, it was Pee-wee Herman. Like, it was my dream. You know, I'd wanted to write about him forever. And he was letting me do this. And we did this amazing photo shoot at this famous old, you know, retro 50s diner, where actually a scene from the credits to his TV show was shot of him riding his bicycle by it, which I didn't even know. And it was like, for me, like a kid in a candy store, just to have access to him and talk about all these things and be able to profile him. And of course, yeah, he had his, you know, downfall, whatever you want to call it, a long time ago. And, you know, you could say maybe he never recovered, but I love when he goes, I say when I want to come back, you know, no one else says it. It's all on my terms. I love that. I love when you're just like sort of defiant in the face of public ridicule or whatever, you know. And I loved his plans for his empire, you know, to sell the whole thing as IP to like a company like Disney. I thought was cool. And then of course this idea that he has this script that he's been sitting on for years that is his dream project, where it's like the dark Pee-wee movie as he describes it, and he like Pee-wee becomes a pill addict and I'm like a monster that's like ego driven monster in Hollywood. And I got a copy of it and read it. And that was so hilarious. That
you think it was good?
It was okay. I could see why like Netflix didn't want to make it. I mean, it was dark and I'm sure he could sell it, you know, but it gets harder even with the CG and everything to sell him in his current physical form as cute little Pee-wee. And he even says at one point, like, well, I don't want it to be like, I forget what he said, maybe Sunset Boulevard or some creepy thing where it's like an actor doesn't know when to quietly, you know, step away.
Right.
But to me, that's colorful and hilarious and funny. And of course, I'd love to see this movie if it got made.
But are you listening to him when he's talking? And are you thinking, is there a part of you that's thinking, no fucking way, like this? I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to be talking to you, but this comeback isn't going to happen.
I mean, it depends on how you define the comeback. Like at the time he was doing a tour with the original Big Adventure and it was selling out, where they just showed the movie and he would come out and talk for like 2 hours afterwards. And everyone was like buying his merch. And, you know, he has a huge following. So in terms of like Pee-wee as a culturally relevant property that's worth something, it's totally, you know, viable and comeback worthy.
Yeah.
In terms of him making one more Pee-wee movie as in his current, you know, age, and it's a dark, crazy one, like, I don't know, it seemed a little far-fetched to me.
Yeah.
But I still wanted it to happen. And if the story could have helped it happen, then I would have been really happy. But yeah, you know, there's only so much he can do as Pee-wee anymore. But it is a strong brand. There's all these puppets and all these other things that could continue beyond him.
This is a random weird question.
Yeah.
When you are eating with someone you're interviewing, yeah, right? Are there foods you do not order?
Well, it's funny with Paul Rubens. I thought I was going to be all clever and cute, and we were going to have a moment when I ordered I ordered like a breakfast, and because I was like, I'm going to make like Mr. Breakfast. Cause like from Pee Wee's Big Adventure, he makes Mr. Breakfast and like the lips are bacon and he talks to it. Mm-hmm. And he just looked at me like blankly. And I was like, you know, like from the movie, you know, Mr. Breakfast. And he just like, and like, he was kind of fucking with me. Like he doesn't indulge. It's like little things like that. He won't indulge like silly fandom like that, you know? But in terms of what I eat, I try not to eat something too sloppy. Because often I'm like nervous and I find like taking bites and eating bowl and then asking your question is just kind of ruins your
rhythm.
Yeah. So I'll order something very light that I can eat with my fingers, but not like a hamburger or
salad. Big salad.
Salad is, yeah. Well, it's funny. I did Army Hammer. We went to his favorite restaurant, which is this Greek, Taverna Greek in Malibu, and we spent the whole day together, and we ordered like a big sloppy thing, and he's like, have some of my lamb, and like, so I ate his lamb, and like, we had this whole fancy lunch together, and then like, now there's all this like Army Hammer stuff going around, and I'm just laughing, because, but anyway, he was the nicest guy, like, I'm team Army.
It's interesting, because I have a daughter who's a senior in high school, I didn't even know she knew who Army Hammer was, and then she's bringing it up every day, she's like, this guy's a cannibal, and blah, 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 blah. You having spent time with him, do you find yourself does having exposure to someone and doing a piece on someone and at least for a moment being a part of their orbit give you a sense of empathy toward them that you probably would otherwise not have had?
I mean, I shouldn't, because I'm supposed to be, you know, impartial journalist, but I really liked Army. Like I really thought he was really warm, and I, you know, we vibed on each other, and that doesn't happen with everyone I interview. So, and I'm still trying to kind of figure out what he's done wrong exactly. Like, did he actually, you know, did he do something that qualifies as sexual assault or impropriety, or I don't know. I actually haven't been keeping up with it enough to really decide whether he's done something wrong. Mm-hmm. But if he got a little carried away with his fantasies, then I don't know. Those are fantasies, and I don't know. That's one where I'm just like, I liked him.
You know what? I would say one thing that's kind of, I was looking at Pee-wee Herman, Paul Rubens, and so he's arrested 30 years ago for jerking off in an adult movie theater. And yeah, I was thinking, like,
he denies even having exposed himself, but the that was what was accused of him.
All right. But here's the crazy thing about it. Like, obviously, you shouldn't be jerking off in an adult movie theater, but you are in an adult movie theater. And I'm sure he's not the first, last, or whatever to jerk off in an adult movie theater. And I was just thinking how, considering everything that's happened over the last 30 years and the craziness of the world, it almost seems like, I mean, I guess because he was a child star, it almost seems so minor to just ruin a guy's career.
Yeah, it was a perfect storm kind of thing. I mean, because he had become this child entertainment megastar, and then he was on the cover of the New York Post, his booking photo, and it just was like wrong place, wrong time, wrong career.
Do you feel, when you're sitting with him, do you feel like you have to ask him about it? And if he doesn't want to talk about it, which he didn't want to, do you feel any that you are compelled to ask him twice about it?
No, you have to ask once. But no, if, but, you know, it didn't matter. He was saying things about it even without me directly asking about it, as I recall. certainly saying I'll say when my career starts again, or, you know, those, that kind of defiance is to me a commentary on it. And he said other stuff that to me was like, okay, this is his take on that.
Right.
And that he said he doesn't want to talk about it. It's going to be in his book if he talks about it at all, blah, 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 blah. But obviously it sucked. And, you know, what's there to say, you know?
Right.
I mean, it was unfair, I think. And it ruined an amazing trajectory. But again, like Shelley, you know, the body of work exists and is still there to take, you know, to enjoy. And he's another genius. And then what was amazing was in the reporting of the Shelley story, he appears in it. Because he, at the end, he was in one of her fairy tale theater episodes, yeah, playing Pinocchio. And this guy, Ryan Obermeyer, who's like befriended her, you know, set up a FaceTime call with Paul on her 70th birthday. And, you know, as one of the people that she lost when she left Hollywood that she wanted to connect with. So I was like, this is so amazing, you know, that there's this thread between the two. And then if you watch this movie that's on YouTube of Mother Goose Rock and Rhyme, it looks like Pee-wee's Playhouse. It's the same kind of 80s, you know, set with like the weird dimensions and everything and same energy of it. And they did move in the same circles and, you know, collaborated with the same artists and people. So it definitely made sense in terms of like things that I care about.
I remember when I was a young baseball writer. So I was covering baseball at Sports Illustrated. And if a ball player sat down with me and gave me time, I think I fell for the grandness of it all. And I'd be like, people would be like, what's so-and-so like, you know? And I'd be like, oh, he's a great guy. He's great. He's blah, blah. And I feel like Hollywood, and I've profiled a few actors, but not a ton, is like that on steroids, where I could see it being very easy to fall for the magic of this person or that person, or being caught up in the, you know, whatever, Armie Hammer is like, have some of my lamb. And you're like, oh, we're buds. This is great. Is that something to watch out for as a celebrity writer? Is it something you have to be aware of? And is it legit?
Yeah, well, like, you know, I'm not deluded into thinking me and Armie are friends. I haven't heard from him since. And actually that story caused trouble for him because he spoke out about Casey Affleck's trouble and that whole thing. And he sort of spoke very off the cuff about it. And then Casey Affleck threatened a lawsuit against it. So he probably hated me after that story. I don't know. I never heard, for all I know. So I guess to answer your question is like, you know, he gave me a great interview. We had a nice day together. He gave me some like very frank, you know, censored quotes that gave my story a little juice. And you write it and you move on to the next one. And, you know, you don't shy away from, you know, making it, you know, controversial moments or anything, but you don't try to construct them either. And you do your best. But like I said, the stories about the stars that are at the top of the world and, you know, have the most handlers and the most are usually the hardest stories because everything is so perfect. And for me, like, I'm looking for imperfection to make the story interesting.
Interesting. Yeah. The imperfect. So you're looking, maybe, I don't know if you feel the same way. I always say like, you look for the small little thing and try to expand it. Like you talked about the kind of cigarettes she was smoking, just as an example. I feel like you didn't just leave it at cigarettes. You called it a parliament and you talked about it. Like, when you say you're looking for the imperfections, what does that mean exactly? Like, what are you looking for?
I'm looking for like a narrative. So, I mean, certainly like the details, you know, it's always in the details. So I'm always looking for brands and specifics. And what I loved about Shelley is that she could remember the name of the bathing suit designer that she was, you know, modeling on the catwalk in 1967. Like, that's great. You include that, you know, yeah. But, and like in terms of imperfection, you know, everyone is like struggling to get somewhere or to achieve something or to move from point A to point B. And so, you know, you want the story to have a kind of momentum to it. I mean, in simplest terms, like think of each story as a movie and it has a first act, second act, third act. And, you know, what does your protagonist's needs, wants, you know, what is, I'm always looking at psychologically what's, you know, what is propelling them, or, you know, why do they do what they do? So the easiest way to think of it is that, you know, imagine this was a movie, you know, how would you grab the audience from the beginning? You know, what journey are you taking them on? What, you know, what is the story here? It's not just everything's going great for Armie Hammer. It's, in that case, it was like he had sort of become famous, but he hadn't really proven himself as any kind of artist. And he had had a bunch of bombs. And so then he was in Call Me By Your Name, and suddenly he had a chance to redefine himself as a true artist. So that was it. Plus he came from, you know, insanely wealthy Hammer family, and they grew up in the Cayman Islands. I mean, he had a really strange, rich childhood. So that was interesting as well.
Does writing about Shelley Duvall, when you're doing that piece, do you get, when then you're viewing Dr. Phil through the prism of writing that story, does it make you want to talk to Dr. Phil and hear his side of it? Or does it make you more just angry at the leets it's Dr. Phil?
No. I mean, it was fully my intention to interview him for the story. And for a few days, I was under the impression that I was going to get the interview. And then they came back to me and said, no, but we'll give you a statement. And I was like, well, that's really disappointing. Why? And then they kind of pointed out to other negative coverage we did of Dr. Phil. And I said, well, fine. So I ran the statement because it was, you know, pretty long and detailed and offered his point of view. But you know, if you read it, you see kind of how twisted his point of view is, which is, we offered her this help. She refused it. She did, you know, like, but never really taking ownership of the fact that the way he packaged her was irresponsible and was cruel to her. He was acting like an altruist, but it was bad. He did a bad thing, and he doesn't seem to want to admit that. So
I just want to say every time.
Yeah.
So my wife is a social worker, and she considers Dr. Phil, Dr. Oz, and Dr. Drew, the Holy Trinity of awful. And every time we would see Dr. Drew doing celebrity rehab, and you have all these celebrities who are down and out and really struggling, and he has them on a TV show living in a house together. Mm-hmm. You realize that part of their family is part of their problem is fame itself and dealing with fame and the fallout of fame. Mm-hmm. You're putting their greatest vulnerabilities in front of you on TV. Mm-hmm. And then saying, I'm just trying to help. Mm-hmm. There's just something uniquely sinister about that in my mind.
Yeah. I mean, I've dealt with Dr. Drew, and, you know, I know, I agree with everything you're saying. But I also know him to be, you know, a decent guy. I don't want to defend Dr. Drew right now, but he's actually quoted in the Gary Busey story because Gary Busey was on that show. And he is a doctor. Same with Dr. Oz. Dr. Phil is not a doctor. And, but fine, there's therapists who are not doctors. But I don't know. It's funny. I've been watching his show for the first time during the pandemic.
I'm sorry. And,
you know, I anticipated this story was coming and I didn't realize it, but I did start to watch it to see what the show was. And to me, it's just another tabloid talk show. Like what's his name? You know, the one where they throw the chairs and everything.
Is that Maury Povich? Now, what was the one where they?
Well, he was one too, but that was the one with like the baby results. But no,
there was Morton Downey. Remember Morton Downey had
Morton
the
Downey. But wait, what's the one that?
Oh, Jerry Springer.
Jerry Springer. Yeah, it's kind of like that. Like he brings these down and out, sad people on to sort of like tell, and he just kind of like keeps hammering them with the same obvious questions, and they kill a full hour of doing this, and it's like you don't know what. Like why? Like what are they going to possibly get out of airing all their dirty laundry like this on in public? And what help is he giving him after the episode? The difference with the Shelley thing is that, you know, we have a connection to her and we know who she is. And he just crossed a line with that. He really did.
Also, this idea that we offered someone with mental illness help and she refused it. Yeah, well, the thing is she has mental illness. So she might actually refuse the help because she's not thinking in the right way to, like, there's so many degrees of awful that went on with that episode, I thought.
Yeah, no, it was terrible. And the worst thing is that that was the first thing you thought of when you thought of Shelley Duvall.
Yeah.
Back to why I did the story. I was just like, no, that's not, you can't do that.
Yeah.
No, well, that's good. I'll do my best to try to change that. So it was very gratifying. I didn't know what the response would be. And it was really good.
Yeah.
The traffic was really good and people really got it. So it felt good.
Let me ask you a final question.
Yeah.
I ask this of everyone who does this podcast. What is the angriest a subject has ever been at you?
It was the BTS. I did a cover story on this this K-pop band. And actually, I never heard from them, but I know the record company was really mad. And then they have this BTS army, which is like a highly sophisticated digital terrorist group. Yeah. And they went full throttle on me for a few weeks. And it was not fun. Although if I could ever take a breath, I would kind of laugh about it because it was like, it couldn't have gone worse. And I went into it so blindly because I thought, oh, they're going to love this story. Like, we put their favorite band on the cover, but I did it my way, you know? And so that it wasn't all like rainbows and unicorns. Like I told some of the, you know, things that I guess, you know, those bands are highly, when you talk about publicists controlling things, yes. In that case, they are everything about them is regimented and controlled. And, none of them are in relationships. They're all available to you, the army, to be your boyfriend and, you know, all these things. And so I guess I just didn't play by those rules or didn't think that there were rules to play by and told my version of BTS. I actually flew to Seoul to meet them and we had a great time. I brought them gifts. We had Korean barbecue.
What could you possibly bring them? What did you bring them as gifts?
It was a last minute thing. And it was one of the controversy. Everything was a controversy in this story. So I was at the airport and they had these like shiny little pins that were like LA themed. So the Beverly Hills sign and like the Hollywood sign and like, you know, LA things, but they were like cute pins, you know, they were like 10 bucks each. And so I bought 7 and I thought as a gesture of goodwill to start the interview, I would bring them. I was like, hey, here's a gift from LA. And they loved them. And they were like, they spent like 5 minutes just like arguing over who was going to get which one. So it was a good icebreaker. But then in the story, I say, you know, I brought it to them and they looked like they really appreciated it or they were good at pretending that they liked them. And then that was a big controversy because how dare you accuse our band of lying to you? They would never lie. And it was like every little thing like that. And what else went wrong? Anyway, a lot went wrong. They did not like that story. And so I felt what it was like to become enemy number one of BTS army.
But how did you find out they didn't like it? What was the first warning sign that this would not be received well?
Because they were like, we were sort of teasing the story the day before and then it went live at a certain time. And then, so I kind of like went on my phone to see, I was like, oh, the story went live. I think they made it go live in Korea first. Mm-hmm. So it was like middle of the night here, but Korea, it was the morning there. And so I started looking on Twitter, is everyone really excited? And like, I saw like angry tweets, like, don't read it. Don't click on it. Don't give them, you know, the traffic. They're horrible and they hate our BTS. And I was like, uh-oh. And it just got worse and worse from there for like several days.
That's very funny.
But I survived.
The funny thing is you and I think we're the same age. Like we know the long view of boy bands, which is 10 years from now, you know, 4 of these guys are whatever, unrecognizable. One guy has a big solo career. Well, like we've seen this movie many times before, but their fans haven't.
I mean, the biggest issue people had with it was that I say up front, I'm 47 and I'm not a K-pop fan, but you know, my editors sent me there because they knew I'd write a kind of like smart, funny outsider's take on this phenomenon. You know, that's what they wanted.
Yeah.
And my editor was like formerly from Esquire. And, that's like a kind of journalism that was popular for many years. But now it's like, I guess you have to be a K-pop fan, like to write about BTS or else you're not allowed. But whose rule is that? That's like the fans' rule.
Right.
And so they were very offended that I don't know. I'm not a K-pop fan. But it's like, well, you don't go into every topic an expert on that topic. You go into it as a reporter.
I did love the line in your story you wrote 48 hours earlier, and I'm on an Asiana American flight from Los Angeles to Seoul, the only 47-year-old man on the plane with a pile of BTS books on his lap.
Yeah, you know, like, I was being honest. I thought it was funny, but they didn't see the humor in it.
We have a creepy man in aisle 43. Can we see the
It's, I thought it was a funny image, but they were like, those are contraband BTS books. Your sources are wrong. Like, there was nothing I could do in that story where I didn't get attacked from some angle. And I just was, at one point, I just was like, okay, that's fine.
Bummer. The cover is really cool, though, I will say. Billion Dollar Boy Band. It's a cool looking cover. Oh, well.
That was the one thing they said, like, we are incensed with what you did with this story, except for the photos, which are wonderful.
You can't please everyone in this business, as you know. Well, listen, man, I am big admirer of your work. Very
so much. I'm so touched.
I've loved reading through it. I appreciate you doing this. I feel like you did Shelley Duvall very well. And I feel like you removed some of the stink of the Dr. Phil experience. And I think that was probably one of your goals. And I think you pulled it off very well. So
thank you. I appreciate, I hope so. She deserves it. She's amazing.
I want to thank today's guest, Seth Abramovich, for joining me on Two Writers Sling and Yang. You can follow Seth on Twitter at Seth Abramovich and read his work in The Hollywood Reporter. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Writers Sling and Yang, please consider going to the vehicle of your choice and giving the show a nice review. I make $0.00 for doing this. It's all about word of mouth. Music is by the fantastic MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. And remember, keep writing.